I don't have on me right now. So I have scribbled notes, but that does not mean that we are not going to have an amazing conversation. What it does mean is that Rick and I just might make up trivia because we still have stuff to give away. Right. Rick plans nothing, so he makes a good team out of both of us. So do you want to do some introductions about the guests that we have?
I would also just a quick point of personal privilege, as they say in the legislature. It is so great to be back in West Michigan because I am a 1980 graduate of West Ottawa High School. And as a matter of fact, I'll even point out that the person who, if I still lived on Little Station Road in Park Township, would be my state representative. Roger Victory is here, so thanks for showing up. And we are not going to have a lot of Republican representation tonight because tonight in Michigan...
Tell me how you really feel.
...is Republican County Convention night, and we will be talking about that with our guests. And so, first of all, I'd like to bring up Field Reichart, whom I will confess I have known since I was a teenager here in West Michigan.
A round of applause for Field.
I don't have time to go through Field's resume, but he started in politics at the age of 14 as a volunteer for George Romney in his first campaign for governor, and he's worked campaigns all over the country, at least the eastern part of the country, and has advised everything from county commission to statewide presidential campaigns here in Michigan. And most recently, you would probably, if you'd heard of Field, it would be because he ran in 2020 for Congress in the Lakeshore. What did I say?
Rick likes to look into the future.
I've got to stop living in the future. 2010, he ran in the Lakeshore district that's adjacent to this one, and he would probably be the first to confess that he comes from the wing of the Republican Party that some people today call rhinos. So please welcome Field Reichart.
Thank you.
Also with us is a veteran legislative staffer whom I've also known for many years and the former Kent County Democratic Party chairman, Ed Kettle.
To the right of Field, not politically speaking, though.
Well, maybe. So, and again, I'll just introduce her one more time. The person at Michigan Radio who, on top of being the executive producer of Stateside, made a resident political junkie a job description in the office. My partner in It's Just Politics, Zoe Clark.
And let's thank modern technology because I emailed myself the notes before we got here for Rick to print out. So as long as this cell phone does not die, we are in good shape. So, gentlemen,
where are we starting?
I want to start with wolves, which might not make a lot of sense unless, you've been paying attention to everything lately. And besides roads taking up a lot of time in the news headlines, we have been talking a lot about wolves. Explain why that is, Rick Pluta.
Does anyone here not know about the Wolf Hunting Initiative, Ed? the state Senate voted yesterday on petition-initiated legislation that would basically upend Michigan's wildlife management rules, primarily for, one, the purpose of allowing wolf hunting in the Upper Peninsula, and two, ensuring that that future referendums on contentious hunting issues like whether or not the gray wolf should be a game species, whether or not the mourning dove should be a game species, that does not happen again.
And one of the issues that this is happening because of is because voters came together, some impassioned citizens came together and decided to create...
Some impassioned hunters.
Some impassioned hunters, who I believe are also citizens. I don't think it's mutually exclusive. Decided to come up with what's called a voter-initiated law in Michigan. So lawmakers can pass laws, but if you feel deeply and strong enough and have enough money in your pockets... You can go out into the field and you can get people to sign what it looks like a ballot. And so maybe some of you signed the wolf hunting law. Maybe some of you decided to sign a petition to make sure that veterans could hunt for free. Did anyone sign that ballot?
Petition.
Okay, or petition, excuse me, you did over here. And
did you know that you were signing a petition to allow wolf hunting?
Yeah, or if you also signed one of the petitions to make sure that you were going to put $1 million into keeping invasive species out of the Great
Lakes.
Like
Asian carp.
Like Asian carp. You, too, signed the wolf hunting ballot. So there's a little bit
of... Did anyone sign that one?
No, but maybe you would have, right, without knowing everything else that happened. So what this means is after you get enough signatures, if you get enough, lawmakers have 40 days to either sign it or it goes to the November ballot, and state senators were like, we're going to vote on it, and they voted on it yesterday. Field, I would love to go to you first. One of the things that we're hearing from Democrats is they're crying tomfoolery that this is unfair, but it is constitutional. It is legal.
It's the way our Constitution is. Before we do that, how many people in the room are independent voters?
Independent voters.
You don't consider yourself particularly a Republican or a Democrat.
Okay. How many are Republicans besides Roger? Oh. There are like 5 or 6 Republicans. And the rest, how many are Democrats? Okay. Well, the independents are basically about the same as the Democrats. That's kind of interesting. The Rick's point is about the action by the Senate yesterday is that it, in fact, is according to the Constitution and the laws of Michigan. What they did was according to Hoyle. Unfortunately, there were a couple of other referenda that were presented to the legislature as well, and they did not act on those.
Well, those were not initiated laws. Those just went right to the ballot for people to challenge them. And the objection to the wolf hunting initiative is that the wolf hunting critics are saying that should go to the ballot also.
Exactly. The thing that's amazing, and Roger, I hope that I know you're a pretty practical guy, but I really hope that some of the very real problems the state is facing, such as the infrastructure in our highways, in our broadband and so forth, become as important to people as this sort of special interest legislation like the wolf hunt.
Rick is asking for a quick temperature check to make sure that we're actually talking about things that we all want to talk about this evening. And I think one of the things that we want to make sure is, are people actually following this wolf hunting?
Have you been paying attention
law?
To this? So yeah.
Okay.
So,
we like to get a temperature check. See if we're talking.
Well, there's
about
a lot of things that have you been following road funding?
So, Ed, let's go to you. You advised plenty of Democrats. I guess what we're hearing from them is it's less about the wolves and more about how they are enacting laws, how Republicans, who are in the majority, are acting laws. How would you advise Democrats? What would you tell them to do right now?
Run.
Okay, just much. Start walking out.
Really not much the Democrats can do because the Republicans have a supermajority. So that allows them to pull through just about anything they want to do, like the wolf hunting and all these other things. When I was in the House working, the wolf hunting thing was an issue, and it was broiling around back then.
Treat it like an ice cream cone.
Okay, good. And it was controversial, but what I learned from it was that there's a great divide between the Upper Peninsula and the Lower Peninsula, and things that are important to the Upper Peninsula may
sure.
not be as important to the Lower Peninsula. So, when we're divided the way we are in this state, things may seem a bit convoluted or changed in ways we don't really care for. So myself personally, I think that the department should still have some control over how our natural resources and how our wild game is being managed. I don't want Ted Nugent to be the guy who decides who and when gets to hunt or what we get to hunt.
You get some claps on that one.
I'm somewhat empathetic to the cause of the people in the North.
But
I have a question, which is that ballot questions can sometimes, but not always, drive voter turnout. We know we're going to have 2 wolf hunting referendums on the ballot. If this initiative is passed, then those wolf hunting referendums are moot. If they're not passed, and actually Representative Victory is going to have to make a decision on that in the next couple of weeks, then it will go on to the ballot, and then it all is active. Is there potential for that particular issue? And right now, I think, Zoe, those are the only statewide ballot questions we're looking at in November. Do those have the potential to drive turnout in a way that could change the game?
Yes, they're going that particular issue with the wolves goes more for the gun owners and the pro hunters and people like that.
On one side.
They will come out. Yes, they will come out and vote in greater numbers. And that's they pick off the margins that way. They build their vote count. And some of those are hidden voters that we don't really know about or normally go to. So,
but don't forget that Oakland County
difficult.
Has one of the biggest Humane Society chapters in the country.
Well, there you go.
Well, so let's talk a little bit more about GOTV, get out the vote efforts, because one of the things that Democrats were really hoping to do is get out the vote in a midterm election. And one thing that we know in politics is in non-presidential years, so this would be, you know, 2014, when a president isn't at the top of the ballot, the Democrats turn out much less than Republicans. And we also know that in a president's second term in the midterms, that party tends to do well. So right now, cards are pretty stacked against Democrats. And some things that labor organized groups are trying to do here in the state is get a ballot to increase the state's minimum wage. How many of you signed that petition out in the field to increase the state's minimum wage? So that's something that they were hoping to put on the ballot to also increase voter turnout. Rick, quickly remind us how it is that folks will not actually be able to vote on that ballot initiative come November.
You know, this was sort of an anomaly that sort of Methuselah journalists like me who've been around Lansing for a while remember the days when you used to sit in a room for many, 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 many hours while the board of state canvassers, and they don't call it board for nothing.
Rick is actually 14. It's just all of the hours he spent there. It's aged him.
Would count signatures. And what's happened is that petition signature gathering has become such a professional operation that to succeed, what you do is you hire a petition gathering an outfit, and the state has just made it easier to do that. You collect probably 100 or 150 or 200,000 more signatures than you actually need, and you don't worry about whether or not you're going to make it on the ballot. Well, the minimum wage campaign was not able to do that, and so they actually they lost the old-fashioned way. They didn't gather quite enough signatures once all the challenges were done.
Well, I want to
right, Ed?
Yeah, I want to stop quickly and also say that if you've got questions, that's one of the things that we love to do is take questions, because we could all just talk and talk and talk, and we will. But I want to make sure that you all interrupt us, because the things that you have to say are way more important than the things that we're going to say, and hopefully we can answer some questions. So Steve Kropinski is going to be walking around with a mic. Raise your hand. Is that how we want to do it, Steve? Just raising your hand and we'll go? Okay. So let's take a quick question. Why don't you say your name and where you're from, and then we'll all be like, hi, Steve. You know, we'll do that back and forth. Yeah. Hi, Jeff.
Do I know you?
So, Rick, if you could talk about a little bit about, though, with the minimum wage issue, was the reason why the petition signatures fell a little bit short was that the legislature rushed through a bill that would have nullified the signatures to begin with, so they really were under a gun to turn in what they had at that moment, which is kind of similar to the legislature circumventing.
Well, they were getting close. They were getting close to the deadline, no matter what. I mean that and everyone knew that they were sort of struggling in the weeks coming up to it, but it was very close. You know, that if they'd had another 2 or 3 weeks, they might have actually crossed the threshold.
Field, yeah. If that had been on the November ballot, do you think it would have? I don't want to say drastically. I don't want to say dramatically. And
would it have been a game changer?
Right. Would it have affected some elections?
Oh, I think it definitely would have. if you look at the legislative districts, when the redistricting was done a few years ago, yes, the legislature designed it to have Republican majorities, but they designed some seats where there was a slight Republican majority, or where they felt with strong candidates and strong organization they could win some seats. So I think the Democrats definitely would have would have won some of the seats. It's, you know.
I want to move on a little bit to what we're going to be seeing.
Could you just linger on that for just a second, though? If you look at the redistricting maps and the way that they're set up, that the Republican majorities in most districts, this is particularly pronounced in the state Senate, the Republican majorities tend to be, you know, 52, 53, maybe 54%. And if you look at the state Senate, if you look at Congress, the Democratic majorities in those districts are a lot more commanding, you know, in the 60s. And what does that tell you?
Well, it's designed very carefully and very scientifically. But if you look at the election in the last election congressionally in Michigan, the Democrats statewide at the congressional level won, 52-53% of the vote? The Republicans won 47% of the vote, and yet the delegation is overwhelmingly members of the Republican Party because of the way district lines were drawn.
They're drawn rather oddly. This past redistricting
was
probably
putting it nicely.
pretty much one of the most drastic and so close to gerrymandering. It is gerrymandering. They've got, you know, some of the districts, one in particular here in Grand Rapids, one of the lines is only about three blocks apart or something. It's just, you know, I get it. I've been in politics most of my life. I get it, and it's legal, and it's done, but it's, you know, come on. Say it like it is. The Republicans want to dominate everything. They want to dominate our thoughts.
And for decades, Democrats did the same thing.
Well, that was different.
It always is. We've got a question. I want to quickly add too that Iowa has recently tried to do a bipartisan, so it's sort of a non-political group that's doing it. So let's be clear, there are some states that aren't doing it the way that Michigan is.
Well, Michigan has tried that. Do you guys remember the APOL Commission?
Well, fill us in. What happened, and why don't we have anything different than what we have right now?
The law in Michigan is that there's actually right now there's a theoretically, a commission of two Republicans and two Democrats.
It's in the Constitution.
It's in the state Constitution. Two Republicans, two Democrats that are supposed to draw the lines. If they can't draw the lines, and how could that possibly be, then it goes to the legislature. And if the legislature can't do it, then the Supreme Court does it. Well, the Supreme Court appointed a commission headed by a guy named Bernie Apel, who was this classic geek that worked in the Secretary of State's office to do...
The former elections director?
He was elections director for the Secretary of State's office. And he designed a very, very effective thing, which was that, when, was it 80? 1980? but basically, that was the one time we really had a decent system, and things switched back and forth. As Zoe mentioned, Iowa has a really good program as well. California's program is fascinating in lots of ways. There, everybody runs in one primary, and if you have two Democrats that are the top two vote-getters, or two Republicans that are the top two vote-getters, that's what goes to the November election. That's a fascinating thing.
Well, it's called the jungle primary, and the idea is that everyone just claws their way to the top, no matter which party that you're in. And it is very controversial, especially in partisan circles, where some political parties, especially some of the smaller ones, go, but wait a second, we believe in stuff. That people don't pay as much attention in the primaries. There isn't the same turnout in the primaries. No matter what, the game where you capture voters' attention is the general, and we want the general to be a battle of ideas. And that's why we want political parties to choose their own candidates in order to win. And as a matter of fact, the Democratic Party is so devoted to that idea. They have built their presidential nominating rules around that principle.
Go ahead, Ed.
Well, I'm just going to say that this whole political gamesmanship, I think, is what's killing the voters. They don't understand this stuff. It's all inside baseball, and it just looks stupid and corrupt and everything else, and opens up the political system.
Unless you're inside.
Exactly. And those of us who are I'm retired now, of course, but...
Emeritus.
There you go. It's too confusing, and it's the best solution for the gerrymandering or the redistricting is to have a totally nonpartisan appointed group of people who will just take these things and look at it from what's sensible to people and not what is going to drive one party or another. I realize that the Democrats did it too. And I'm just the kind of guy, I don't like a railroad job, even if I'm driving the train.
There'll probably be a petition circulating on this in the next couple of years. And sign it.
Yes.
We have a question over there, but I'd like to ask the people, what? Just quickly by applause, would you prefer to see a state commission drawing these lines, like two Democrats, two Republicans? Yes, no? Just give us some time.
All right, so we have a couple questions.
All right.
Remember when we were talking about wolves?
Wolves?
Yeah. Well, that's what I had my question. Are there any wolf hunters here? And you're all going to vote on wolf hunting. I think the wolf hunting thing is a metaphor for how government can kind of get hijacked. And there's some sad little man who wrote his doctoral dissertation on how wolves affect farming. And that's the man who I want deciding about wolf hunting. How can I empower that man instead of the man who wants to do wolf hunts or, you know, how can I empower a intelligent, invested person
you
in an issue instead of the person
to...
with a...
Well, I mean, I don't want to rain on your parade, but... The people who are doing the anti-wolf hunting initiative, the one that's up for a vote in the state house in a couple of weeks, they say that what this will do is this will basically require that the process is governed by wildlife specialists at the DNR and the Natural Resources Commission.
Good.
Although there are two prominent wolf biologists who say that what the DNR and the NRC did with the wolf hunts was driven by politics and the desire of actually probably one politician in the Upper Peninsula rather than stopping, you know, wolf predation.
Will that all be explained in the initiative that I get to vote
hell
on?
No.
Yes.
I'm not an informed voter.
My guess is you will not get to vote
on
it. I think the House probably passes it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we've got some other questions. Maybe we should just do some more questions.
There should be no obtuse angles. It should all be rectangular.
I agree.
Well, I'm going to howl back at redistricting moon and away from the wolves, if I may. We got two moons outside. But more comments. First of all, Florida even put their voters put in a plank in their constitution that said that party cannot be a consideration in drawing lines, and a state judge just dinged two of their districts and say, you are going to redraw these right now before the next election, and they had to go in a special session to redraw those two.
And what you're talking about is a fascinating, fascinating political story that is, I think, being underreported, which is whether or not districts in Florida will actually matter come November, because they are right now in a bit of a crisis trying to figure out if and how they're going to redraw maps and quickly. So that is a story that's absolutely very interesting. But that's happening in Florida. So let's talk Michigan.
And the thing about California, Louisiana has had that for years. Mm-hmm. They've had that kind of primary for years. But as far as a two Democrat, two Republican commission, get the parties out of the room. Please give us something like a 7 or 8 member commission, nonpartisan, that goes in and does the drawing and says you've got to have as square as possible, no snakes. And yeah, I realize with Detroit, we're going to have to deal a little bit with the civil rights issues. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is what a lot of it, and this is what a lot of it hangs on, is that federal law requires not only that districts be compact and contiguous, but also that, and this is what a lot of it hangs on, that the process respect the fact that there are communities of interest. And actually, one of the ways that the small number of very, very dominantly Democratic districts was justified was they said that they followed the migration patterns of voters out of Detroit and drew districts based on that. That was the underpinning of the intellectual argument behind those districts. So, I mean, because otherwise you could conceivably just, put it to a computer program and leave it at that. But the thing is, someone's still got to make the decision who's going to appoint the commission or who's going to choose the computer program. And what you're asking is that we take the politics out of politics.
We've got more questions.
Hi, folks. I'm Scott Smith from Grand Rapids.
Hey,
as I got on my bike to come down here, my wife said, "Tell Zoe I said hi." Sorry, Rick.
What is your wife's name?
My wife's name is Lori.
Hello.
Anyway, Rick made one of my points here is that just to tag along what he was saying is that take the partisanship out of it, and he was talking about a committee. I say take the humans out of it. There's population and there's representatives and senators. An algorithm can do that. I'm not a programmer myself, but I know it can do that. If they can't decide in a computer program, we have way more problems than we're going to solve with an
again,
election.
But civil rights codicils to that say that you also have to take into account that we're not going to break up communities that have a commonality of interest, especially minority communities that have a commonality of interest. And that throws a wild card into your algorithm.
Okay. There would be population centers, and the commonalities, what are they? Are they socioeconomic? Are they
that's
heritage?
That is the question.
I think this is a story for stateside that maybe we need
okay,
to
but anyway, but
no, just to
keep going on with that, is that do parties serve any purpose in an election or making a law? And are we just perpetuating more of the same BS when we have primaries?
Okay.
And then we have super majorities. What's wrong with a 51% majority? Look at the national level. We don't have anything getting done because of the F word.
Let's go to Field and Ed on this. I think Rick and I are just like, we're going to go to the bar and have a drink, and we're going to let these two talk that one out because that goes right to the heart of why these two gentlemen are here.
The fascinating reality here in Michigan is that for probably 70% of the seats in Congress and in the legislature, the primary is the election. And that's really because of the way district lines are drawn. So what tends to happen, and we cleverly schedule it in August, when really only the zealots in each of the parties are paying attention to what's going on. I ran against Bill Huizenga in the Republican primary in 2010. There and one of the wonderful people that worked with me is sitting in the back of the room. Hello, Rick. I looked at it and I said, hey, there are six very, very, I won't use the E word, Republicans running for this. I have a shot as a seventh person who's basically an old-fashioned Bill Milliken kind of Republican. Could I win? No, because I could not get my friends that were independents to get into the Republican primary. I couldn't get Democrats to understand that the election was in August.
18% turnout in this past primary.
Actually, a little bit less than that.
And
17.7%.
That's the thing. You just had a situation right here, and it was fascinating, the Amash Ellis primary. And Ellis made, I think, a very strategic error. He should have beat Justin. But he went too far to the right. He tried to get to the right of Amash, which was really stupid, and because that's pretty hard. Although, folks, look at what he said yesterday about the incidents in Ferguson, Missouri. It was very interesting. Same with Rand Paul. Very interesting stuff. But then Ellis, sort of the last week, said, oh, the only way I can win this thing is by doing a Thad Cochran. And, you know, I've got to get the Democrats to vote for me. Well, it was too late because he painted himself off into the corner. If he'd started to run as what this district is, a Jerry Ford, Vern Ehlers, Paul Henry, Hal Sawyer kind of Republican district, and he'd run as that and all along been telling people, hey, the election here is probably the primary in August, then Ellis would have had a chance. But they didn't think that way. They went, they said, we got to get to his right, and they did. It's crazy.
With mixed results all across the state.
Yeah. Ed, I want to go to you.
Well, that is a prime example of not only Ellis having, because they analyzed the primary voters, and they're all teabaggers, basically. And so they had to swing pretty hard to the right. Sorry.
Children in the room.
Oh, sorry. But that was the reality that he had to face. He had to go that far to the right to be effective in his own primary. What that says is that's not something that's wrong with elective politics. What that says is there's something wrong with the Republican Party because they've been hijacked by a very extreme faction. And so the good Republican Party, as Field has described, they're kind of wandering around in the desert right now. They can't find their feet because of all these very extreme values that are being shoved down their throats and ours.
They seem to be, but it seems to me that the Tea Party, whether or not it had a name, has always been an element of the Republican Party. As a matter of fact, quite a few years ago, back in 1987, the first big political story that I covered was the first big statewide political story that I covered, and it was a national political story, was the primary fight, the Michigan primary fight, between George H.W. Bush on the one side and Pat Robertson and Jack Kemp on the other side, and just up the street at, what was it, Field, DeVos Hall? It was the Civic Auditorium. We had two competing conventions and then lawsuits about which delegates were going to be sent to the national convention. Which, by the way, if anyone here in the room has or has access to a T-shirt that says, I survived the 1987 Republican presidential delegate selection process T-shirt...
Rick will pay good money.
I will pay money for it.
I have actually been looking for the past 2 years to buy this shirt for Rick. I look probably once a month on
eBay. They have these at this.
And I
have these at the convention.
One.
And one of my great regrets is I did not buy one.
Interesting historical thing about that, though, Rick. That was a year in which Michigan, at least the Republicans in Michigan, were ahead of Iowa and New Hampshire. We were
ahead. That's part of what made it such a big deal.
That's right. And we did it in 84. I wrote the rules, so I know. We did it in 84, and we had set the precedent in 84 when nobody noticed, because no one was running against Reagan.
Right.
So we had the precedent set, and we did it again in the 86 to 88 process. And we were the first in the country then. And boy, did we get attention.
So we are going to take a quick break and do a trivia question. It is time. So what we have as our first gift, our first, pint glass, Michigan Radio Issues
whoa, whoa, whoa,
and
wait,
Ale.
Wait. You know, I need one more.
Pint glass. So Rick is going to toss out the question, and I'm going to go grab another drink while you're doing that.
How many Democrats in this room just clap your hands? I have really bad news for you, that in the past 100 years, Democrats in this congressional district have sent just one of their own to Washington, D.C. Who was it and why? Steve?
It was Vanderveen because of the Nixon Watergate fund.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Wins. Do you want to extrapolate? Okay. Yes, it was Dick Van Der Veen. Dick, right?
Dick.
Yeah, yeah. And he ran for the seat that was vacated by Gerald R. Ford when he was named Vice President of the United States, the only President of the United States to never be elected nationally at any level. And part of Van Der Veen's campaign platform was that he would vote to impeach Nixon and make Gerald R. Ford the first president of the United States from Michigan. And he was reelected just once. Oh.
Yes.
I can multitask.
God, that was fun to do.
So let's talk a little bit about what we're likely to see.
We did have another question over there. Did you want to?
No. Did you have a question?
Because that was such a fascinating bit of trivia. No.
Okay, right. I want to move on to what the legislature is likely to be up to when they come back in September from their summer recess. Road funding kind of hit, it crashed and burned a big thud. The last day of session before they recessed. I want to talk a little bit about today. In fact, state senators met, a bipartisan group of state senators met to try to talk about road funding, and they're saying that they are going to have to start from scratch. Rick, what does this tell us about where state lawmakers are right now, that it seemed like everyone could agree that our roads needed to be fixed, and yet it didn't get done?
Well, one of the things that it says is that it's sort of funny. When Zoe and I first started doing It's Just Politics, one of the things that we talked about was the fact that we sort of treat politicians like the aliens that walk among us. You know, that there are these creatures. They look like humans. They act like humans. They blink and breathe. But in fact, they're politicians. You know, and actually, lawmaking and politics is the most human of processes. So right now, the whole road funding debate is really focused on the state Senate, because the House took on a lot of big controversial issues, especially ones that were important to Republicans. And what happened was there was a meeting of the Republican leaders, the governor, the House Speaker, and the Senate Majority Leader. And just out of the blue, the Senate Majority Leader, Randy Richardville, said, yeah, you know, we did the Detroit Lighting Authority, came out of the House, and a couple of other big controversial things out of the House. It's like, you know what? We'll do road funding. And his staff went, "Erp." Really?
That was the press release was "Erp."
"Erp." Yeah, the headline was "Erp." It was like it just a bomb dropped in the moon. Like, oh, you'll. I was not in the room, so it was, but it was like, oh, you'll take that, really? And then all of his aides went, "Yeah, really?" And so now, having taken responsibility for that, that developing a plan that can get enough votes in the Senate and then hopefully enough votes in the House is in the hands of this work group that the Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville has put together. And they met today, and what they did was what we've seen on controversial, complex issues time and time again, whether it's road funding, whether it's school funding, which is another example of something like that. They said, you know what? Everything that's been done before is valuable and informative, and we're going to start
it
from zero.
So, Ed, from your experience working in the legislature, advising these kind of lawmakers, what, and I'm sorry to put you in this position to have to even try to figure this out, what are they thinking right now? What's the long game that they're trying to figure out by not putting money into roads?
Well, I was a staffer, and I actually worked on the study that was delivered to the governor that gave factual proof of why we need to spend the money on roads. And
that was $1.2 billion.
Right. Actually, it was $1.6 billion, but they thought, let's shave this down a bit. But it was a great study, factually based, and it was a reasonable price. and you get it to the legislature, and you're going to get football with an issue like this anyway. Somebody's going to try to pork barrel it so they get more in my district or whatever. That's natural.
Which
but
is
that
what we saw
that
with the version with the mini transportation budget that came out of the House.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, that, but then that got clogged up. So, but the bottom line is the overwhelming thought down there is we need to reduce government, lower taxes, do all this kind of crazy stuff, and the reason and the way we do this is starving government. We starve the government to lower the size of government, and one of the ways we can do it is this, and that price tag is too big because, oh, maybe the roads could be privatized. Maybe we can have toll roads and all these things, which they're just nuts. The roads are part of the people's landscape. We own those roads, and we have to maintain those roads because it provides free and open access between cities and places for not only just for our pleasure to travel down, but for millions of dollars of commerce.
But nobody disagrees that there's a need. It's how you do it,
right,
and whether or not, basically, it's how you come up with revenue,
right,
whether you should come up with revenue, and if you're in the Tea Party, whether or not state government already has the resources necessary to come up with that money if only they would cut
and
government.
And this is where we hear this phrase, waste, fraud, and abuse, a lot, which is that, Field, I want to get to you about this, which is this idea that there is enough money in government right now that state government pays for things. And I was talking to Todd Corser today.
Explain who Todd Corser is.
So why don't you go ahead and explain who Todd Corser is. Field, I would love to hear your explanation of who Todd Corser is.
Todd Corser is a person who ran for chairman of the Republican Party 2 years ago in the convention. He's from Lapeer County. He's never really been a leader in the party until he appeared with the Tea Party crowd in the last few years. He came within just a hair of votes of defeating the party chair. He is, to put it sweetly, an extremist. They're basically one from Allegan County, one from Midland, won the Republican nominations for their state legislative seats, and also one up in the Petoskey area they're Tea Party people that have not been in the legislature before. It's going to be very interesting. Roger Victory, who's a moderate conservative state representative, has left. He's escaped because he probably knew this was going to come.
He left because he had to go to his county convention.
He has to go to his county convention. I know that. But
Brian Kelly needed it.
Corser is really interesting. But I will tell you, folks, the Tea Party, the process within the two parties, the Tea Party got mostly hosed in Michigan during the primary. In the precinct delegate races around the state, they really lost a lot of ground. I personally think that the party is kind of coming back a little bit to the middle. Ottawa County Republicans nominated a person with the last name of Garcia, who happens to be a female. That's a change.
Why is the Republican governor unable to get the Republican legislature to pass road funding that he wants?
He's not a politician.
Actually, I have my own theory about Governor Snyder. He has this reputation of having been the CEO of Gateway Computers. He wasn't. He was the COO. He was the chief operating officer of Gateway Computers. And what he would do is implement the policy that his board gave him. And I think he is looking at the legislature, and if they hand him something that he doesn't really disagree with phenomenally, he'll go along with it.
And I think a classic example of that was
the right to work legislation was a classic example. His comment was, "Oh, well, this doesn't really matter that much to me. You know, it's not on my agenda." But boom, then he signs it. And regarding the road stuff, I mean, there are so many interest groups. Guess who's one of the biggest opponents of an increase in use taxes? The trucking industry is in there lobbying like crazy. They need the roads more than anybody. But boy, they don't want any taxes on the use of the roads. And the gas tax alone isn't going to do it, because our cars are becoming more and more efficient. Thank you, Father. And we're driving less, and we're using more and more public transportation. So the gas tax increase alone isn't going to fix the problem. And these guys, it's really interesting. I have another thought, though, on what happened in the primary. I talked to you about the fact that the election for many people is the primary election. Well, already there are lame ducks in the legislature who were just renominated and they're going out in November. There's some state senators that are going out in November. There are a number of state representatives that are going out in November. So they no longer have to worry about the primary for their election.
Which is the major election.
Yes, which is for them their major election. So some of them may basically say, hey, I'm going to do the right thing rather than the politically correct thing. It'll be very interesting to see.
Well, people are interested in it. I would look toward lame duck for road funding.
So let's talk quickly about LGBT rights and the State Civil Rights Act. It's called the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. It protects people, race, gender, ethnicity, from things like housing.
Weight, marital status.
Mm-hmm, from housing discrimination, job discrimination, things like that. Sexual orientation is not part of the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. There's a gentleman, a House representative by the name of Frank Foster, who lost his primary. He is a lawmaker from Petoskey who last summer actually, Rick broke the news that he was going to most likely be the Republican actually to introduce sexual orientation to be part of the Civil Rights Act.
Well, we can even backstory that just a little bit.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, just for many years, what was it, 1982, that Jim Dressel?
82 or 83.
Jim Dressel, a Republican from Holland, sponsored a bill to add sexual orientation to Elliot Larson. He lost his subsequent primary.
Right. It was 84, and so it's been 30 years
ever
later.
Since then, it was a Democratic bill. Mm-hmm. And then in this last session, Democrats were asked by the LGBT community to refrain from introducing a bill because they believed that they had a chance at passing it, and it required, in the current environment in Lansing, with Republican majorities in the House and the Senate, to get a Republican sponsor, and they had one in Frank Foster.
And so, like I said, Rick broke the news last summer that Foster was We broke the news last summer that Foster was likely to introduce it. He very quickly got a primary opponent, Lee Chatfield, who won last week. But what we're hearing now is that we may see this LGBT rights added to the Civil Rights Act actually as soon as September. Randy Richardville told me, he's the Senate Majority Leader, that he will, in fact, not only bring it to the floor, but that he would vote yes on it.
Foster told his local newspaper, the Petoskey News Review, that as a lame duck legislator, he will introduce that bill.
Ed, from your perspective, is this something that will pass the legislature before, this session?
I, in my own perspective, I doubt it will. I don't think the Republicans are going to be able to gather up the votes, because there may be some floats, like Field suggested, the guys are getting out of there, and they may get brave and do some right things, but there's just as many who are going to just stick their feet in the ground, and you need a certain number of votes. And there's probably even some Democrats who will feel unsafe in their own district and maybe not vote for it. I think it's most telling, though, if you think about this, what kind of a society do we have that we even need to have laws like this, where we have to place it in the form of a law? Basic civil rights should be a one-stop shopping thing. You either have them or you don't.
One of the reasons there's going to be a lot of pressure to do something before the end of the year is because with the Tea Party caucus that's coming in, especially to the State House.
Todd Corser, who we were talking about.
Gary Glenn. But we're also going to have more gay legislators than we have ever had before serving in the legislature and in the
which
State
I
House
think
also.
Goes to our next trivia question. Who can name the first openly gay member of the House of the Michigan House of Representatives.
In the Michigan House? Michigan.
Jeff Kent.
Okay, how about this? Can you guess what city he lived in? I gotta see a hand.
Whatever
I
you said
see
in the back,
hand.
Yes, absolutely.
He yelled out Ann Arbor. That was indeed Chris Kolb. Chris Kolb is Chris no longer in the legislature. He served in the legislature from 2001 to 2007. There are now no openly gay candidates in the State House of Representatives, but two candidates did win their August primaries in mostly Democratic districts. So if there aren't any huge October surprises, it's going to set up a very interesting session where you have people like Todd Corser and Gary Glenn who are vehemently anti-LGBT rights, anti-gay marriage, working alongside, for the first time ever, two openly gay candidates.
We have had plenty of gay legislators. They just weren't there. Jim Dressel came out toward the end of his life.
Yeah.
Leon Drillette, a Republican from Macomb County, came out
about 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
I don't think that the Democrats are going to push this too hard for the lame duck session. I think they want it on the ballot as a referendum in 2016 because it will help to get their vote out in the presidential election.
And I will quibble with that.
Now, that's what I think. I hope they pass it. I really do hope they pass it. But if they don't, if there's just sort of some lukewarm lip service for it, but not a real push, watch.
Democrats wanted it on the ballot this year in order to drive turnout, and the LGBT rights...
National leadership said wait.
Yes, because they were working it in other states, but the state Democrats wanted it on the ballot this year because they thought it would help drive turnout, but the LGBT community said, you know what, we would rather have this on the ballot in a higher turnout presidential year. And it's one of the things that you see when people are planning political campaigns, that there's sort of a yin and a yang, that you want to draft on movements and candidates that are going to draw out the same voters that you want, and everyone's kind of looking at each other. As a matter of fact, there's a story about it. I'm blanking on his name. The great governor who was also the mayor of Detroit, attorney general, Supreme Court justice. What? No, it wasn't Soapy Williams.
Trivia question? Anyone? Anyway? You do know it?
Rescue us.
What?
No. He was a mayor of Detroit, a governor of Michigan, a U.S. attorney general, and a United States Supreme Court justice. Frank Murphy.
There you
All
go,
I had to
Frank
do is remember the Hall of Justice.
Rick
in
wins
Detroit.
A pint glass.
Well, my pint glass. Frank Murphy, who was probably one of the most amazing politicians to come out of Michigan that no one knows, was actually recruited by Franklin Roosevelt to give up his job as the Governor General of the Philippines to return to Michigan to put his name on the line and run for governor and help FDR win Michigan so that he could become president. And it turned out to be, when the votes were counted the other way around, that FDR helped Frank Murphy win Michigan to become governor. And so, politicians, strategists, they try to plan this, but you never know for sure until the votes are counted.
Well, in the last 10 minutes or so that we have, and you were talking about the governor's race, so should we talk a little bit about two of the big marquee races coming up in November, the open U.S. Senate seat and the race for governor?
Okay.
Okay, well, let's first talk about the open Senate seat. Carl Levin, 36 years in the state Senate representing Michigan, announced his retirement last year. We have an open Senate seat between Gary Peters. U.S. Senate seat between Gary Peters and Terry Lynn Land. Field, as a Republican, how is Terry Lynn Land doing?
I've known Terry since she was a sophomore at Hope College, about the same time I knew Rick. Terry is a very nice person.
I see where this is going.
She is, you know, it smiles.
She's a nice person, and she smiles.
And there's the problem. If you're going to run for office, you need to be able to talk to people about the issues. She's not nearly as stupid as she may seem. Her staff has basically put her into a room, and they take her out when they need to film a TV commercial or to make an ad. I've known Terry for a long time. Her instincts, she's a good person. But the way this campaign is being run, which is a sign of the way modern politics are, is that your media advisors run you. Now, having said that, I don't think she has a prayer.
But she smiles.
I agree with him.
Yeah, Ed. Well, that's the analysis of the U.S. Senate seat. We have a smiling woman.
I have a follow-up question, though. Wait, so you guys are both saying that you really think that this race is just over?
I don't. I think that Terry's going to continue to get a lot of money from the Koch brothers.
No, they pulled out yesterday.
They did, really?
Yeah.
Well, God love them. Well, yeah. Just on the surface, I know Terry very well, or not very well. I've known her for a long time. She is one of the most partisan people I've ever known. She's a real good party hack, but that doesn't. And I, to be honest with you, I thought she did a good job as county clerk and as Secretary of State. She's a great, really good manager and bureaucrat, but that has nothing to do with being a United States Senator. So, and Gary is way more prepared to go there. He knows Washington, and he's just far.
Could Gary Peters still lose this?
Anything's possible. You never know. We can get some weird tidal wave of activity over here that would.
I've talked to some Democrats who say that they're concerned that if and when there's a debate, that Gary Peters will basically go Al Gore on the whole thing and lose it there.
And Terry will smile. and the other thing that she may do is she may come into that debate prepared and surprise everybody. She's not stupid, folks.
No. So we want to get to a lightning round of questions in about 3 or 4 minutes.
We have a quick question in the back, though. Okay.
Yeah.
Yell it out, and I'll repeat it.
Yeah, shout it out. Hi, Daniel. Oh, okay. Okay. Then we're going to do about 3 minutes of analysis on the gubernatorial race quickly. Quickly, we've got Governor Snyder versus Mark Schauer. Ed, was Mark Schauer a bad choice for the Democrats?
No, I don't think so. I think Mark is able to articulate the positions of the Democratic Party more than anybody else. He's soft-spoken. He's not the best guy in a big room, but one-on-one, and in his advertisements, he's very good. But he's also very smart about campaigning. He's only lost one election. And that was a kind of a sweep year. I wouldn't rule him out by any means. I think he's a tenacious campaigner, and I think he'd be a good governor.
Does the string of polls that show that this race is within the margin of error accurate or too rosy for Republicans? Too rosy for Democrats.
Yeah. There's always that opportunity. But the bottom line is, we were talking about earlier, we were in the House and we watched the governor come in and we said, well, we'll give him a 6-month honeymoon, that kind of a deal. The Republicans gave him about 3 weeks and they beat him up. He's not a politician. He's a good administrator, but he's not a politician. He couldn't see this stuff coming. He can't manage either House. And if you're not a politician, you don't understand what the ground game is in the House and the Senate, you're not going to get much done.
But voters don't vote for politicians.
Who don't?
Voters.
They don't vote for politicians? Who's left? Who's running?
They vote for visionaries. They vote for leaders. Right. They vote for. I mean, they don't vote for politicians. Right. LBJ may be what we need, but it's not what people tend to desire. Right. But my question was, are these polls that come out that are coming out and saying that this race is really close within the margin of error, are they overly optimistic for Democrats?
I don't think so. I think they're probably right on, because it's not just one poll. There have been several polls taken, and they all seem to add up.
There have been about five.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean.
Did any of you all hear Governor candidate Schauer on Michigan Public Radio about, what was it, 3 weeks ago when he was on your for a morning and you were talking to him?
I asked my executive producer.
It was 5 weeks ago
tomorrow.
5 weeks
ago. Did any of you hear that?
The host was great, I thought.
He was terrible. Beyond terrible. I couldn't believe it. And every call that came in, which shows a little bit about the producers, every call that was coming in seemed to be coming from a member of his campaign staff. And he still couldn't answer their questions.
But he smiled a lot.
It was the incredible
smile.
That's great. That's great.
Okay. On that note, let's take some questions. We're more than happy to talk about more of the governor's race, but Steve is like, let's get going here. So, okay. No. Okay.
Good question. Well, okay.
He's really been waiting.
Ed, you mentioned the polls. And if all of you could, when you announce the polls on the radio, tell us if they're for likely voters or not likely voters. I think that's really important.
Don't get me started.
Yeah. No, Rick and I are, like, as a social studies major, it drives me nuts that we talk about polls that are 600 voters. If you actually want to believe any kind of poll, you need at least 2,000 people. You need to know whether they're mostly cell phone users or not, because, of course, cell phone users skew younger. So I think what we like to watch, what Rick and I like to watch, are trends in polling rather than specific polls.
But the big shortcoming in polling in this election cycle is pollsters are doing a lousy job of identifying likely voters. That if you're looking at a poll and you get a chance to look at the what they call the crosstabs or the list of questions, if there is one question asking about, you know, do you consider yourself likely to vote, whatever, then they're really not trying to winnow the field, and they're not giving you a really good sense. They may be giving you a good sense of public opinion overall, but they're not giving you a good sense of who's going to be deciding the question in November. And I have not seen a poll that has satisfied me that they are winnowing out really who a likely voter is.
And I'm going to just quickly do a really quick shout-out for Michigan Radio, because one of the things that we purposely don't do is report on specific polls. You won't
or Michigan hear, Public Radio.
Yeah, we won't do reports. We'll look at trends. Rick and I will sometimes talk about it, and it's just politics about certain trends that we're seeing. But you will never hear a news report that's just this poll says this or this poll says that without at least some sort of deeper context.
What's behind my question is issue of turnout. And so can you just quickly summarize the statewide ratio of Democrat to Republican, let's say 2008, 2012, and what it's probably going to be in 2014? And remember, Obama carried Kent County in 2008.
Well, he carried a lot of places. Classically, Michigan has been a third state, that we've been a third Republican, a third Democrats, and a third independents. And we are now a purple state. We would be a blue state if Democrats turned out in midterms. What we've seen is that Republican turnout tends to be pretty consistent, and Democratic turnout is sort of up and down, that they come out in presidential years and then they stay home in the off years, and which is why actually this year that there are some years where the campaign is about, you know, they're both running neck and neck, and there's this narrow band of independents that we need to persuade. This year, the game is Democratic turnout.
Talk a little about Lon Johnson, what Lon is doing.
Oh, I mean, it just is. I mean, you know, that's just factual.
Lon Johnson, the new chair of the Democratic Party, has actually identified 800,000 Democratic voters that sit out.
994,000.
Okay, so closer to a million.
But it's almost a million.
Almost a million. Say that again.
Mostly
women.
Young, single women, urban dwellers, but they figure if they can get the Democratic Party here in Michigan has a plan, and they figure if they can get out a third of the Obama voters, then they can win. And that may seem like, oh, yeah, a third of the Obama voters, done and done. That's a big deal. that convincing people who are not motivated to vote to get out and vote.
You had a question. He's been waiting in the... Oh, okay.
Wait, one more.
No. It's okay. We're here. We didn't see that. Sorry.
Run the microphone back.
We're going to get a pint glass or something.
Hi. Tim Feistein. Hi, Tim. Quick question from Grand Rapids. Quick question. Just getting back briefly to the Wolf issue. One thing stands out to me about that bill, the idea of changing the rules so that in the future nobody can, in the future, change, you know, the rules back. Is that an unusual step? Can you even do that? And has that ever been done before?
Are you talking about the $1 million appropriation so that it's referendum proof?
Well, it sounded like you were saying that in the Wolf referendum that they not only changed the rules for hunting, but they also made it so that future referenda cannot change the rules back.
They did, and we really didn't explain that. The Michigan Constitution, in the same way that it says that a group of citizens can get together and initiate a law, that you get to be a bill sponsor just like a legislator, a group of citizens can also challenge a law. We're one of only 8 states in the country that allows that. And you can go and collect petition signatures and put on the ballot something that says, we don't like this law, the rest of you, are you with us or not? And they get to vote yes or no on the law. This happened twice with the wolf hunting bills. But the framers of the Constitution said, we have to protect the full faith and credit of the state of Michigan. And so if it's a budget bill, then you can't challenge it on the ballot. And so that's why that's like that.
But what we've seen happen is things like the emergency manager law, the second one, there have been
the first emergency manager law was repealed by a referendum. Right. So when they passed the second emergency manager law, they put in an appropriation.
Yeah.
When they decided to repeal the line item price, the item pricing law,
right,
they said the union said that store workers said we're going to go to a petition drive and challenge that. So they made sure they put in a referendum. We've seen that several
referendum
times.
Things like $50,000 to print out ballots to explain the law. Yes, you have waited, and like we're so giving you like a hat or a pint glass or something for
waiting. Johnny has a hat.
Is this thing on? Okay. Hey, Nathaniel Fennessy, live in Grand Rapids. So real quick, I mean, the governor's race is the big ticket in Michigan right now. My question is going to pertain to that very quickly. All I'm going to ask is, let's think a paradigm shift here with these primaries. We had a lot of focus on primaries. I really want to quick get to that. Okay, wouldn't it be in the voters' interest to... possibly voters could vote in the Republican and Democrat primary. Just think about that, people. I don't want a response on that. Now, about the governor's race, the big issue here is think about this road funding, waste and corruption. The governor's, I believe it was cousin, got a $40 million furniture contract. That's 4% of the $1 billion that we need for this road funding. These appointees have all resigned in scandal. Andy Dillon still receiving pay after he left. Two scandals. So these are huge issues with Rick Snyder's accountability, and I'm just not hearing anything about this. Aren't these big, pertinent issues that voters need to know about going to the polls?
Well, then how do you know about them?
It's out there. Progress Michigan, 95.3 Union Ads. People are, you guys not?
We have a few minutes left, and I guess I want to put that in perspective, that I think it's fair to say that these are all scandals. I think it's creating a very good narrative for Democrats to use against Snyder, that he is a rich businessman that takes care of his friends. If you're a Republican, you're probably going to not believe that. If you're a Democrat, you probably are going to believe it. Rick and I have actually done a lot of It's Just Politics segments about what's going on, and if you want to give me your email address, I'm happy to send you those stories. Okay. Oh, well, so you do hear them.
Yeah, you.
But I guess... But Ed, I want to quickly wrap up with you with this question. Are Democrats doing enough to hammer the governor on these scandals, on these issues that make him seem like he is out of touch and that he is, in fact, which he is, a millionaire and not looking out for the little guy?
Yeah.
On his vacation home.
Yeah, he's every day he says something, every day he gets a photo op, anything that we can collect, we're going to use against them. That's just a natural wave of politicians, of politics. That's just how it works. So don't fret, my friend. All those things will be well publicized sooner or later.
Okay. Field.
40% of voters make up their mind on how they're going to be voting in the last 10 days. That's why everybody's buying their TV ad time now.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
One more quick thing I want to say. One of the key things is candidate recruitment for the parties at the lower level. And there are two interesting races around here that you all, and one of the candidates was in the room. He's just left. Lance Penny's running for the state Senate here as a Democrat. He's running really hard. I don't know what he's going to do, but he's going to help get voters out. And there is a fascinating candidate in the Democratic Party for the state Senate down in Ottawa County. It's a lawyer by the name of Sarah Howard, who's a Warner Norcross and Judd candidate. She's running against Arlen Meekoff, who's a unique member of the state Senate. And
very likely the next Senate Majority Leader.
And, which is amazing. And Sarah is going to run really, really an interesting race. And she's going to, I don't think she can win because that county is very, very Republican.
It's one of the two most Republican counties in the country.
In the world.
Okay, so it is 7:35, but we started a little late, Steve, so I think it's okay. Okay, but I would like to put this out there. Rick and I are more than willing to stay. We'll probably grab another drink. But we're more than willing to stay and ask and answer any other questions if you want to keep chatting. We want to let people who need to get out of here get out of here. But I don't know about Field or Ed, if you're willing to stay for a little bit, if people have more questions for a little bit of time.
We do have one request?
Yeah.
Collins.
Yes. So here is our request for everyone, though. If you are so willing and so inclined, Field was talking a little bit about that we had a Mark Schauer call in on the Michigan Public Radio broadcast 5 weeks ago. We have another one coming up a week from tomorrow with Gary Peters. Both Governor Snyder and Terry Lynn Land have said yes. Rick and I are still trying to figure out times. But Rick has his recorders, and what we would love to do is if you've got some questions, we would love to record them right now to have banked audio for the show, and hopefully we would be able to use it in the show if there's time, if the executive producer says okay to it.
So no promises, but if you're willing to do it, you could be part of a statewide broadcast.
So come find Rick after we end this broadcast, and we would love to hear what your questions are for the candidates. I think that's it. Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. Sorry we started a little late.
Thank you to Ed Kettle and Field Reichardt.
Lending their perspectives.